Thanks. Yeah, never anything to declare. Those are fascinating talks, and I'm sorry I came in late for the first one. I had to talk briefly next door at the Peace Caucus, but hopefully I'll try to tie the theme together somewhat. Do I have a little extra time, if I understand correctly? How are we working this?
About 20,
three speakers?
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Okay, it's a complicated story, so I'm going to have to go pretty quickly. Basically, what I'm going to try to do is tell you the story of the Bayer Corporation. It's a story of corporate malfeasance and how it affects public health. It's a part of a larger area of interest of mine, which is that. And if you look on the website, again, my website, if you just Google public health and social justice, it's the first thing that comes up. Go to the website. A longer version of the slideshow is there on the food safety, food justice page. And if you really want to know all about corporations and public health, there's a number of slideshows on the activism and education page. But there are a number of other pages. The slideshows are all updated every 6 months. It's all open access, meaning you can take all or part of a slideshow and use it for your own purposes with appropriate citation. So I'm going to try to weave the story of the Bayer Corporation and how it's had an impact on the overuse of agricultural antibiotics, how honeybees get involved, the Nazis, the anthrax scare, and try to tie this all together. And it'll seem like I'm all over the map, but hopefully by the end of it you'll have a sense of how corporations work, because Bayer, unfortunately, is very typical of a pharmaceutical company, and a sense of what we might be able to do to stop essentially the internalization of profits and the externalization of healthcare and environmental costs. So we're going to start with the agricultural antibiotics story, then I'll give you the history of Bayer, then we'll talk about the anthrax letter scare that some of you might remember from the post-9/11 era, and then I'll have some conclusions. So there are almost 9 billion animals per year treated worldwide to promote growth. The claim is that treatment, and by treatment I mean basically giving all the animals in a herd the antibiotics, will lead to larger animals and fewer infections in the herd, but in fact this doesn't really have a lot of scientific backing, this claim. If you look at all antibiotic use across the U.S., you'll see that non-therapeutic use accounts for about 70%. So most antibiotics that are used in animals, and the amount that's used has gone up 50% over the last 15 years. Very little is actually used to treat infections in livestock. Some is used in things like soap to treat pets. Human therapeutic use of antibiotics only accounts for 15%. And there is some category crossover here. But most antibiotics that are used, particularly in agriculture, are sold without a prescription, basically just over the counter. The U.S. leads the world in agricultural antibiotic use. You can see we're the country on the right side there, followed by Greece, Netherlands, Spain, France, and going all the way down to places like Sweden and Norway. And you may have heard of CAFOs. These are the concentrated agricultural feeding operations. They make up only 5% of livestock operations in the U.S., but they produce more than 50% of our food animals. There's 20,000 of these in the country, and they have much higher rates of use of non-therapeutic antibiotics. U.S. antimicrobial use in food-producing animals in 2010 is listed on this graph. These are some of the main categories. You see a lot of these we use in humans, tetracyclines, penicillins, macrolides, sulfa drugs, aminoglycosides, cephalosporins, and so on. And as a result of overuse of antibiotics for not treating animals, you're going to select for bacteria that live on and in those animals that are resistant to some of these major antibiotic classes. And as a result of this, when we prepare food and may not cook it adequately or touch our hands to the surface where we've cut up raw chicken or something like that, we're going to get foodborne infections. And these foodborne infections tend to be resistant to the antibiotics that those animals were already showered with, sometimes literally in the CAFOs and elsewhere. And as a result, the CDC claimed many years ago that antibiotic use in food animals is the dominant source of antibiotic resistance among foodborne pathogens. So how common are foodborne illnesses? There are different estimates. Anywhere from 48 to 76 million people each year in the U.S. suffer some form of foodborne illness, leading to 325,000 hospitalizations, around 4,000 deaths, and those who are affected have an increased risk of autoimmune disorders, predominantly GI and rheumatic. and that this leads to over $150 billion in medical costs, lost wages, and lost productivity. So just to give you some examples, we've seen a rise, this is all over the last decade, in fluoroquinolone, which is like Cipro, levofloxacin, moxifloxacin, fluoroquinolone-resistant Campylobacter. Campylobacter is now the most common foodborne bacterial infection in the U.S. Vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus faecium, and this is VREF. This is probably due to the use of avoparcin, which is a vancomycin-like antibiotic in chickens. Both gentamicin and cipro-resistant E. coli in chickens. This is linked to diarrhea and to UTIs. Methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, which is associated with pig farms and much higher carriage rates among those who work and live near industrial pig farms. And we have seen some moves to try to curb the overuse of agricultural antibiotics. So in 2012, the FDA issued voluntary guidelines to reduce antibiotic use. There is an act that's pending in Congress and will probably go nowhere for the next 2 years, or known as PAMTA, or the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act. And many organizations oppose the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in livestock, including the APHA. Now, this is a problem because as bacteria become more resistant to antibiotics, one would think that we need more classes of antibiotics. But if you look at the total new number of antibacterial agents that were developed, you can see the number is 16 between 1983 and 1987. But over the last 4 years, really only two new novel agents to treat bacterial diseases. So now I want to shift gears a little bit. We will come back to agricultural antibiotics because Bayer is involved there. I'll tell you a little bit about the Bayer Corporation. They're based in Leverkusen, Germany. They employ over 100,000 people worldwide. They have 40 billion euros in revenue last year, making over $3 billion in profits, and their largest market is in the United States. They're involved in pharmaceuticals, and many of you may have heard about them first. I know from children's baby aspirin, Bayer aspirin, and adult Bayer aspirin, which is a very sort of good image. They're also the world's leading pesticide manufacturer. They're one of the world's largest seed companies. And if you weren't at my GMO talk prior to this, there is a talk on the website that goes over GMOs and biofarming because Bayer is very involved in that whole process. They also manufacture BPA, which is an endocrine disruptor. And they got started by trademarking heroin in 1898, which they marketed as a cough syrup for children that they said was without side effects, despite the well-known dangers of addiction. They then patented acetylsalicylic acid as aspirin in 1899. In World War I, they invented the modern chemical, chemical warfare and developed the School for Chemical Warfare. And in the Second World War, they were part of the IG Farben conglomerate, which exploited slave labor at Auschwitz and conducted a number of unethical human subject experiments, some of which are detailed in another slideshow on the website on the history of human subject experimentation, including being one of the founders of Mengele. They manufactured and supplied Zyklon B to the SS for use in the gas chambers. And 24 of the company's board members and executives were indicted in the Nuremberg trials. 13 received prison sentences, the longest of which went to Fritz Meer. He was convicted of plundering, slavery, and mass murder. He was released from prison in 1952, and just 4 years later, he was made chairman of the supervisory board of Bayer. And there's a similar history if you look at the human subject experiments that took place in Japan, many of the chemical and biological warfare experiments. A medical student of mine about a decade or so ago did a project where we looked together at what happened to those Japanese scientists, air quote, who did things like spin people in centrifuges while they were alive, who cut off limbs and deliberately infected them with botulism and anthrax and other organisms. One became head of the Japanese Heart Association, the other was a dean of a medical school. Many of them went on to positions of prominence, and there was no equivalent, really, there was a minor one, but not on the same level. There was no equivalent of the Nuremberg trials, and one of the reasons for this is that many of those so-called scientists, aka torturers, were brought by the U.S. to Fort Detrick in Maryland to begin our biological and chemical warfare program. In the early 1990s, moving farther ahead, the company admitted knowingly selling HIV-tainted blood clotting products, which infected up to 50% of hemophiliacs in some developed countries. In Europe, at least, the taxpayers were left to foot most of the bill for the healthcare costs of these individuals. From 1995 onward, they have failed to follow their promise to withdraw their most toxic pesticides from the market, and they've been cited in a number of countries for failing to educate farmers regarding pesticide risks. Now, the risks of pesticides are very important and are encountered not just in the United States, but worldwide, where many pesticides that are outlawed in this country can be used. In the U.S., however, there are 300,000 pesticide-related acute illnesses and injuries each year. There's 25 million worldwide. The National Academy of Sciences has said that pesticides in our food, and that's about 5 to 8 pounds of pesticides per person per year applied to crops in the U.S. that we eat, that the pesticides in our food could cause up to 1 million cancers in the current generation of Americans. And the WHO has said that as a result of these pesticide injuries, illnesses, cancers, and so on, that 1 million people died over the last 6 years due to pesticide exposure. Coming back to Bayer, in 1998, they paid Scottish adult volunteers $750 to swallow doses of an insecticide to, quote, prove the product's safety. So these were truly desperate people who signed up for this study. And in 2000, they were cited by the FDA and the Federal Trade Commission for misleading claims regarding aspirin and heart attacks and strokes. In 2000, they were fined by OSHA for workplace safety violations related to carcinogen exposures. The same year, they were fined by the Commerce Department for violations of export laws. In 2001, violations in quality control in their factories contributed to a worldwide clotting factor shortage for hemophiliacs. In 2002, they had to withdraw their drug Bakal from the market when it was linked to 100 deaths and 1,600 injuries, and they were accused by Germany's health minister of failing to inform the government of the drug's lethal side effects by keeping secret proprietary data. In 2006, their crop science division had a genetically modified rice that they were planting in the southeastern U.S., known as Liberty Link rice. It contaminated the rice supply. Bayer kept the contamination secret for 6 months. When the EPA found out about it, they kept it secret for another 18 days. Ultimately, when it became public knowledge, the European markets immediately slammed shut to rice imports from the U.S. because they did not want our genetically modified rice. And the worldwide cost estimates of this go well over $1 billion, and there are many, many court cases still pending related to this. In 2007, they suspended sales of Traysol or aprotinin 2 years after data showing increased death rates in heart surgery patients. Again, they withheld that data for 2 years. This is very typical of companies to withhold information that has safety concerns. Look at the story of the ignition switches, the airbags, and so on. In 2008, the FDA warned Bayer regarding unapproved marketing claims for their women's low-dose aspirin plus calcium and their Bayer Heart Advantage. This is a really scary event. This is in 2008 when an explosion at their Crop Science Plant Institute in West Virginia killed 2 workers. Now, at that same plant where the explosion took place, they have an above-ground storage tank that can hold up to 40,000 pounds of methyl isocyanate that was just 50 to 75 feet from where the blast took place. Methyl isocyanate is the same chemical that blew up, basically, in Bhopal, killing over 10,000 people and injuring many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of others. And they also had an underground storage at that same site that could store an additional 200,000 tons of methyl isocyanate. It's not clear how much methyl isocyanate was actually on site when the explosion occurred, but this could have been a massive industrial disaster in the United States that most people have not heard about. In 2009, they were ordered by the FDA and a number of states' attorneys general to run a $20 million corrective advertising campaign about their birth control YAZ. In 2010, they were cited by Political Economy Research Institute as the number one toxic air polluter in the United States. And from the late 1990s to the 2010s, Their pesticides have been implicated in honeybee colony collapse disorder, these so-called neonicotinoid pesticides that are contributing to the dramatic decreases in bee populations. These pesticides might also harm birds and other mammals. And just last year, the EU placed a two-year moratorium on these pesticides. So their corporate agenda basically has been to internalize profits and externalize costs. Their obligation to their shareholders is, of course, to make money. They do this through corporate front groups that bolster their image and act to send blast faxes to Congress and build up support for various measures. They can harass watchdog groups and bring slap suits, which are strategic lawsuits against private parties. They're basically harassment suits. They're anti-union, and they have a very large lobbying budget and tremendous contribute a lot in campaign donations. Again, if you want all the details, the longer version of the slideshow on the website has the numbers and so on. Now, I said I was going to talk about anthrax. You may remember when people got letters filled with anthrax prior to 9/11. Fun fact, I guess, prior to that, the FBI said that once a day, on average, in the years before 9/11, some organization in the U.S. received a letter filled with a powder that was claimed to be anthrax. Once a day, pre-9/11. But things were sort of ramped up after 9/11. People became more aware of this. There was a greater concern. And there are different treatment and prophylaxis options for anthrax, which when in its pulmonary state it has a very high mortality rate. Penicillin is one option, tetracycline another, and Cipro, which might be slightly clinically better than penicillin and tetracycline, but not a huge amount. Cipro would be, of course, the most expensive treatment option. At that time, Cipro was the best-selling antibiotic and had been for about a decade. Part of the way that Bayer kept it to be such a great seller is that they paid Bar Pharmaceuticals and two other generic competitors $200 million, basically not to manufacture generic Cipro, despite a federal judge's decision that allowed those companies to manufacture the generic Cipro. So if you go back and look at pricing, in the drugstore was $4.50 in 2002 to buy a pill of Cipro. And the U.S. government had the authority under existing law at the time to license generic production of Cipro by other companies for as little as 20 cents per pill in the event of a public health emergency, which certainly the thought of widespread anthrax was a public health emergency if it was dropped from, say, crop dusting planes onto a major city or dispersed in a subway somewhere. The U.S. didn't. Instead, it cut a deal with Bayer to reduce the price of Cipro, but not as low as it could go. So they agreed to buy 100 million tablets for 95 cents a pill. Interestingly, that was twice the amount that the government was paying under other public health programs like the VA and the Indian Health Service to buy Cipro. So Bayer clearly got a bit of a sweetheart deal for this. And even so, a full course of Cipro for post-exposure prophylaxis, or 60 days, would cost the government $204 per person compared with just $12 per person for doxycycline. Canada acted a little bit differently. Joel probably knows more about this, being the expert on Canadian pharmaceuticals. They did override Bayer's patent and ordered 1 million tablets from a Canadian manufacturer. Now, why did we do this? Why did we allow Bayer to sort of get away with this and the government? Why was our government compliant or involved in this? Well, they were concerned that this would lead to that allowing generic manufacturing for very cheap would weaken our case that we were presenting at the World Trade Organization meetings, that the massive suffering consequent to the 25 million AIDS cases in sub-Saharan Africa did not constitute enough of a public health emergency to permit those countries to obtain and produce cheaper generic versions of what at that time were largely unavailable anti-HIV drugs. Well, this, of course, opens the door to many questions involving parallel importing and compulsory licensing that could have harmed Bayer's bottom line and threatened their massive profits. And the pharmaceutical industry, of course, is the most profitable industry in the country. So here's two views. These practices were felt to be very fine and dandy by the business community. In fact, in 2001, at the end of the year, Fortune magazine named Bayer one of the most admired companies in the United States. whereas Multinational Monitor, the same year and again 2 years later, voted them one of the 10 worst corporations of the year. So in conclusion, hopefully I've weaved together all of this into a somewhat coherent tale, showing you that corporate profits and influence peddling often triumph over public health needs. What we need is we need much stronger regulation over agricultural antibiotic use, or we are going to be in a big mess as we see higher and higher rates of antibiotic-resistant foodborne infections. We need much more stronger regulation over drug pricing, and one could go on for hours or a book. In fact, as Joel, I know, has one coming out next year dealing with drug pricing in Canada. And, of course, stiffer penalties for corporate malfeasance. I would not only fine these companies, but I would put anyone who is in management who was knowledgeable about what was going on that contributed to deaths, I would try them for murder. Place them in a maximum security prison with a vicious, acromegalic, sexually starved roommate with violent tendencies. Now, I would make them pay for this. And I think, unfortunately, we don't. We don't hold the heads of companies accountable when their practices knowingly lead to death, and they knowingly cover that up, which leads to more death. And ultimately, all they face are fines, which are simply a slap on the wrist and considered a cost of doing business. So if you want an article reference on this, I wrote something about this for Z Magazine over 10 years ago. I would say look at the slideshow instead. It's more up to date. That's the website again. Feel free to contact me through the website. And we're good?
Thank you to all three of our speakers. We have some time for questions. Right here in the front.
So, first of all, Martin, Canada only threatened to issue a compulsory license for Cipro. It never did.
I stand corrected. Thank you.
And second, on your point about sending people to jail, there was a book that came out in, I think, 1984 called Corporate Crimes in the Pharmaceutical Industry by an Australian criminologist named John Braithwaite. And as part of the book, he interviewed executives in a number of drug companies and found out that at least two companies had a position which translated as vice president in charge of going to jail. In other words, this was a person who was appointed to this position who, if somebody in the company was criminally charged, that was the person who agreed that they would take the responsibility. So the companies have already thought about jail time.
What's the salary scale for that position?
Talk about that.
Another question? Right here. Mm-hmm.
One of the tie-ins, I think, between the two talks of Dr. Robes and Dr. Donahue's talk is that the idea of regulating these companies, I mean, is part of a larger capital system, which is now a hyper-accumulation situation where financial capital is taken over, so that the circulation of capital is more and more rapid, requiring greater and greater and speedier growth. What everybody's disposable.
rehabilitation in these attitudes begins early. I didn't mention it more than a couple words on the slide, but these corporate-sponsored educational materials that are distributed to cash-strapped schools go beyond just ag, biotech, and pharmaceuticals, and praising the merits of GMOs and so on. But some of you may have heard me rail on about this before, but there are curricula that are put out, say, regarding energy that are given to physics teachers. There's one called Exxon's Energy Cube, which has statements like, offshore drilling creates reefs to support a viable fish population. Or solar power is simply, or oil is simply solar power hidden in decayed matter, which is a true statement that somewhat obfuscates the issue of where oil comes from and its damage. Or there's one on forestry that's from the American Forest Products Council, where it says Great American Forest is renewable forever. I could give you a number of these that are statements that are used in curricula throughout the United States to inculcate young people in the given corporate messages to minimize the health and environmental consequences of their activities.
Yeah, I think it's the same in community building and the way we're looking at urbanization. So, for example,
people are having trouble hearing you.
Oh.
You want to come over to the mic, maybe?
My colleagues yesterday, Munoz and Aviles, presented in the Socialist Caucus about Harvey's recent book, The Contradictions of Capital. And I think it's really important. It's very connected to what I talked about in, as far as neoliberalization and these strategies, you know, the deconstructing what that really means so we can get in and change it. And the more I look at this, the more I see that there is nothing but that out there, this contradiction of capital. And again, I'll go back to Johns Hopkins University just because I'm very familiar. Again, I challenge everyone to find the contradictions at your institutions because they're there. We're all part of this capitalist system, so they're all there. And if we haven't discovered it and we're not lifting it up, it just means that we haven't done enough yet. We're not doing our role yet. Hopkins displaces over 50 years, more than 2,000 primarily African-American and low-income families so they can expand into more than 150 acres of land. And yet, they are the leading institution to be the economic anchor and to offer that model, the same model that used to displace 800 families for their expansion, using that model as a model for economic development, as an anchor university, as an anchor institution. What a contradiction, right? We're not looking at the value. We've allowed these corporations to create value, and we completely disregard the exploitation of our most vulnerable. Walmart, that's not a great one, right? So they started a campaign to feed them and hunger. What is it? Create. And I love it that they actually use create because it ties back into this whole, again, the neoliberalization strategies, the creative and the destruction, to create the end of hunger in the world through their feeding campaign to end hunger. Now all they need to do is pay all their employees a livable wage, give them full-time employment if they want to, and local benefits, and folks will lift themselves out of hunger. And yet, these contradictions of companies and corporations creating the soil that's fertile for exploitation and wealth accumulation for some, in turn become the ones that then lift or change that dynamic. And somehow, I think the population, the majority of the population, has missed the first part, the exploitation piece. And we somehow cling to the hopeful piece, maybe because we're hopeful people as humans. but somehow this contradiction and becoming very clear, and that's why I really challenge, I think, as people coming into this venue, we really need to become active agents of change and really look into the institutions we're affiliated with, whether it's nonprofit, for-profit, government, university, hospital, it doesn't really matter. As part of a neoliberal capitalist structure, we are participants in this. And so the only way we can change this is if we need to really look at how our institutions are participating in it.
Got a question right in the front, and then we'll go to you in the back here. Thanks. Comment there, and do you have a question in the red?
Yeah, a little bit of a question, but also more of a comment, which is just this is really important to also think about given where we are physically. If you all remember Hurricane Katrina, folks actually died in this very building. Folks were like left behind. Folks didn't have the ability to get out. Many of whom come from neighborhoods that are very underserviced. Many of whom have now lost those neighborhoods because of the redevelopment process being incredibly about importing capital. Further out now into the parishes, there are still 100,000 residents who have not been able to return to the city. It's important to even think about it, like where we are physically in this area.
Right here.
Okay, so how do I even frame the question here? So I'm Chris Kuhl, I work with the Detroit Urban Research Center and the University of Michigan. People in Detroit are well aware of what's happening with their land. Well, and that was thought by this one, Detroit, a great opportunity. And in addition to all the setting some criteria for sustainable development to build into their RFAs for all of the development proposals that are coming in for that land. Well, you know, years ago we saw this happen. I didn't know that I would get invited to that table. Of course, they were right in Washington, D.C. But it's just, so I come here with ideas and inspiration, and I get so discouraged.
Well, you just named one thing, which is we, the three of us at least, and I know there's others in this room from other cities, you know, Atlanta, people I don't know here, we do need to talk, right? So outside of this room, meaning we continue the conversation because everyone has the wisdom because we've been doing it. So I think that's one very specific strategy that is a step forward. You know, I always come back to the basic just because, from before I went into academia, I was an organizer. So, right? So I always come back to that because, you know, after 20 years of being involved in research, what I've discovered is research is organizing, depending on how we use it. It's the same thing. You talk to someone, you find out what they're doing, what you listen to them. That's data. What do we do with that data? What do we do with the evidence that we collect? Well, I'll tell you practically what we did with it in East Baltimore when Hopkins decided that they were going to take land without telling people, and people found out about it in a newspaper. We door knocked, we collect that information, and we were the only ones as a community organization who had the information as to what people in that community wanted. That was power. Because no one else had taken the time to ask people what they wanted. So that was a very, this isn't, well, maybe we should do this, this might work. This is what allowed us to basically stop the demolition process that was demolishing a house right across from a resident who was not informed that when they came home at night, there would be lead-based paint floating around, particles floating around in their home. So that actual organizing, that ability to say, we know what 300 residents in this community feel, and this is what they're saying. You have no clue what folks feel. If you're truly about redevelopment for this community, this is what we do. I don't think that I think that we're still lacking, a lot of us who do this work are still lacking the respect and understanding of the wisdom of the communities that are impacted. I think we still haven't figured out how to make that merger. In doing organizing work, you almost have to give up the research hat because they're almost, in the way that we're structured, they're almost incompatible. And I say that as someone who did give up the research hat and became a full-time organizer again for 6 or 7 years after getting all the MD, PhD, and all that stuff. And I saw the difference. So this is from experience. There was a difference where being in the community, with the community, of the community, allowed a different kind of organizing. These are risk-taking. These are practicing what we're preaching. These are times now when if we really want to change what we're doing, we really have to do it. And this is why I say action has to inform research, and research has to inform action. Is I think that's a way to start to build the bridges together. I think we go back to the community. What do you take back? Go back to the community. Find the community organizers that are really willing to knock on the door and bring people out to meetings. Start building that movement. movement, start building that people movement, the impacted, empowered movement of the people, not the research-driven movement of the people, not the us coming in, the researcher telling folks what to do because we have the data, but the data that we've shared back. I mean, I think that's very practical. I think the research and the movement has to go hand in hand, not because it's a good thing to do. But I always go back to the organizing. I always say folks who are impacted are the ones who have to sit at the table, bring their experience to the stakeholders and say, this is the face of what you're doing in my community. Now you need to listen to me. But I really do practically would like to pass a piece of paper around and say, this is part of the movement. This is the movement here, right? This conversation is the energy of that. So thank you, it's a great question. And for those in the room who have the wisdom also, they may be able to offer other suggestions. But don't give up yet, we haven't even started.
It is past 4:00, so I'm sure that all of our speakers are willing to stay after. I think we can stay in this room until the next session at 4:30, but if we can thank them one more time for the talk today.